Welcome to episode 20 of the Serious About Security podcast for Tuesday, November 13th, 2012, brought to you by the Greater Lafayette Security Professionals Group, Secure Purdue, and the Center for Education and Research in Information Assurance and Security, or Sirius, at Purdue University. Let me introduce the host of today's podcast. I'm Preston Wiley, CISSP, CCNA.
This is Keith Watson, Research Engineer at Sirius.
And I'm Mike Hill, CISSP. In announcements today, the Sirius Security Seminar has more great speakers in the next few weeks. Hal Aldridge from Cypress Electronics will present on November 14th. There is an open session on November 28th. If you're interested in presenting on that date, please use the contact link on the seminar webpage. The seminars will be held at Stewart Center in room G52 at 4:30 p.m. on Wednesdays. They are also broadcast live on the Purdue channel in the Lafayette area. They are also available as podcasts and on YouTube. See the Sirius website for more details, www.cris.purdue.edu.
We have two items in news today. Both are Adobe updates. Adobe fixed a critical issue with the Flash player. I'm not going to say the versions on this podcast because they are too numerous to name. You can look at the security bulletin to find out which versions are affected. And Adobe Air had a critical security issue as well, which was fixed. If you run the Air app, it should trigger a notification to update your installed Air version, and you should update it because, as I said, it's a critical security issue.
So this week, we thought we'd talk a little bit about the New York data centers and their issues they had with Hurricane Sandy. And these are interesting, in my opinion, because now we're talking about a situation where reliability and availability come into play when providing network services for a lot of the internet-based services that we use all the time. And a lot of these providers and a lot of the connections to the world come through Manhattan. And it's interesting to note that as the hurricane approached, that several of the data centers actually happened to be in evacuation zones, in areas of low-lying ground in which it is likely that a flood would occur. I believe several years ago, the city of New York decided to, or at least update, let's say, their storm or emergency preparedness plan, and part of that included, you know, what are we going to do if a hurricane comes and we have storm surge? So they looked at kind of the elevation of landmass on the island and tried to determine what areas would likely be inundated with floodwaters and at what level. And using that information, they created the various evacuation zones or flood zones, that sort of thing, and basically use that plan to determine areas where they would evacuate people in order to avoid loss of life due to flooding. So you may recall that some areas in Long Island were evacuated, parts of Lower Manhattan were evacuated, and there were several data centers in Lower Manhattan that happened to be in the evacuation zone. So some of these had some pretty serious issues when the floodwaters started to rise. And so we wanted to talk a little bit about that today and kind of review kind of the timeline, if you will, of some of the issues that occurred. And we want to look at it from an availability point of view. And when you're designing a data center, this is usually where you're clustering a large number of computing systems and a lot of network gear. And the idea is that you want to provide a controlled environment in which you can continue operations nonstop 24/7, 365, even in the event of issues. And so you prepare for that by creating a data center with the proper environmental controls and backups to those environmental controls. You're also looking at physical security, redundancy in your network and your computing infrastructure. And one of the issues that we often see, not just affecting data centers, but a lot of critical operations such as hospitals, for example, is when emergency strike and their emergency plan kicks into play, they run into issues. Some of those are related to generators frequently. Generators, typically, if you go to a hospital environment, they have a pretty extensive emergency power system because a lot of the patients in the hospital require electricity, if you will, to power the devices that keep them alive or monitor their health. And so those devices, typically if you go in a hospital, you'll see a lot of things like IV drip machines or equipment in operating room theater, for example, are plugged into little orange outlets. And the orange indicates that that's emergency power. So if the hospital were to suffer a power outage, the backup generator would kick in with a reasonable amount of time. And typically, in most of the hospitals I've done assessments at, they use very sophisticated Caterpillar or some of the other major vendors of these systems. They're very large diesel generators typically, and they can run for days given enough diesel fuel. And these systems are usually tested and run for several hours each week. It depends on their testing cycle, what the vendor recommends, but often it's, you know, run it for 4 hours once a month and run it for an hour once a week, that sort of thing. Usually the testing plan varies depending on what the vendor recommends that they do. But at data centers, I've also seen situations where the generator is not as well maintained. And sometimes when the generators have sat outside for years on end, they may not work reliably and consistently. And some of the issues, especially in an urban area, you have to place your generator in the right location so that you're not disturbing the neighbors with the noise from the generator, because you're going to be running it once a week to test it, that sort of thing. You've got to have a place to put your fuel for it. And then you're talking about environmental health and safety problems with that. And this seems to be the issue that we ran into here with Hurricane Sandy. A lot of these things, a lot of these data centers had emergency equipment. They had emergency generators. Unfortunately, they put their fuel pumps, fuel tanks, and often their generators in the wrong locations. So typically, we see generators being placed on the roof. Sometimes they're placed in a basement, depending on the building configuration and what's allowed in whatever area they're operating in. But sometimes the fuel tanks are located in the basement, and in order to get fuel from the basement to the roof, there's a pump system that's used, and these pumping systems are usually located near the tank. And we had a few issues where that actually caused some significant issues. So if we go and look through the list here, we've got Verizon Business, which is at 140 West Street. This one was interesting. It's the company's headquarters. It has a 5-level basement, and 3.5 levels of it were submerged. What's interesting about this particular case is that the cable vaults were in the basement, and the equipment, the telecom equipment, was higher up in the building. So the equipment itself wasn't damaged, but all the cabling that connects all that equipment was located in the basement, which was damaged. And they actually had to bring in backup generators to the street level and build a temporary tank placement, and then route the cables in through a second-story window to actually power the equipment higher up in the building. Very similar to what they had to do during 9/11 when they had similar sorts of outages of power. The other interesting one was at 75 Broad Street. This is in the evacuation zone. They had a flooded basement, which damaged their fuel pumps and fuel tank, and they were not able to get pump fuel up to the roof, to the generator. So they actually used a bucket brigade and hauled buckets of diesel fuel 17 floors to the roof to fill the tank. That's some dedicated people there, let me tell you. Atlantic Metro reported some issues with 325 Hudson Street, again, a failed fuel pump. And then once they got fuel for it, the generator failed and it needed parts. At 121 Varick Street, they had also flooding in their generator room. And basically, the generator vendors came in and said they can't even fix it. It's a total loss. So they got a temporary generator there as well. And then 33 Whitehall Street, flooded basement, and they had to bring in a roll-up generator as well, 2-megawatt generator delivered. Now, this one was interesting because it took Gawker Media, Gizmodo, and BuzzFeed offline, which are fairly major internet sites. And if you went to things like Lifehacker, for example, you got a very short thing saying Hurricane Sandy has affected our operations, and they sent you to a Tumblr log. So you could go to Tumblr and you could kind of read some of their stuff, but their main site was down for quite a while until I believe they moved it to a new service. At 111 8th Avenue, this is actually the Google building, and they have a lot of telecom company equipment there. Again, fuel pumps couldn't get diesel up to the roof generators. And so Equinix and InterNAP reported issues there. And then finally, another one I'll mention, 375 Pearl Street, also kind of on the edge of the Zone A evacuation area. They were kind of spared from flood damage, but still had some other issues. So a lot of these places had some fairly significant issues and affected some popular internet services. So I think from a security point of view, one of the things in our usual confidentiality, integrity, and availability issues, availability came into play here. And so that's kind of the summary of what happened in terms of some of these data centers. And so we can talk a little bit more about why these things occurred or what happened or why what if you were a customer of these services, what you should have done or thought about. So what do you guys think about this?
Well, I like the Verizon analogy. It makes me think of Titanic. You know, they had 5-level basement and 3.5 took on water. I'm curious, you know, how much they could have taken on and still not been interrupted. It seemed like there's a common theme throughout many of these things where the fuel pump was in the basement. And I'm, you know, I just wonder if this is kind of a lessons learned sort of opportunity. It seems like, you know, when you're preparing for disasters, you try to take into account several different types of scenarios that can play out. So, you know, in Verizon's case, they had some very critical equipment not located in the basement. So that was good. Yet some of it was, and that flooded, and that still knocked them out. So, you know, I'm curious, you know, are we recommending now that that fuel pump should be on the rooftops with the generators? I mean, in that event, it seems like there's other scenarios that becomes vulnerable too. I mean, should there be duplication? Should you have fuel tanks on the roof and in the basement? Does that become cost prohibitive? What can we, you know, or do we just look at this situation and say, you know what, a storm like Hurricane Sandy doesn't come around every year. These things are not that common. What do we take away from this? Are there lessons that we can learn that we can, that we can apply to our own organizations? Even those of us that are not on the East Coast, can we look at this and say, well, you know, these were some big businesses. They were running some major sites, you know, Verizon, Google, these are not small players. They had a lot, to protect, and you would think they had some of the best plans in place. And I'm not saying that they didn't, but can we look at this and say, you know, they still got hit in this way? Are there things they can walk away from and say, okay, next time we're going to do things a little bit differently, so in the event something like this happens or something similarly happens, we're going to be better off?
Well, I think this might be an example of where health and safety trumps security. I mean, the fact is the fuel pumps and the fuel tanks were in the basement due to health and safety reasons. You don't want your tank leaking and, you know, and getting all, I guess, you know, up and up on the roof, and then it, you know, just gets all everywhere in the building or whatever. And I think this may be an example of where, you know, safety trumps security. There was probably a realization that if a hurricane hits, there might be a problem here. But, you know, you can say, well, you know, is our availability more important than safety? And that's never true. So I think this may be a case of that.
And you may be right. So two things I'll mention, and there's really a lot to talk about here. I'm going to mention two things. I did deal with a hospital in southern Indiana in which they had relocated their data center, which used to be in the basement, to a second floor office space. And they did a complete build out and put in new equipment, new, fire suppression gear and, UPS and all that stuff. What was interesting in that case, what prompted them to move it from the basement to the second floor was not that they had a problem, but because another hospital in southern Indiana who happened to be located near a river, and 3 years ago we had some pretty significant river flooding, they actually lost their entire data center because it was located in the basement that was flooded. And so this hospital decided they did not want to go through that sort of situation and allocated funds and actually moved their data center to the second floor of the hospital in a different location just to avoid that issue. So the point is, I think, just as we saw a lot of financial firms realize that on 9/11, they didn't have a second facility that they could use and be back up and operational within a short amount of time if for some reason Lower Manhattan was attacked or some other issue occurred, data centers now may have to go, wait a minute, maybe this is not the best place to locate a data center. And they may say, you know what, I'm going to move it further inland, or I'm going to locate it in a different location just to avoid these weather-related issues. In conjunction with that, there's a Wired article, which I included, which the title is Why Manhattan is the Worst Place for a Data Center and the Best. The best part comes because customers have asked for it to be there. When they have a co-located data center and they want to have their servers nearby, where do they want it? They want it in Lower Manhattan. The reasons for that can be, it's just easier to get to. It could also be a timing thing. A couple of issues back in Wired magazine, there was a discussion about shaving the amount of time it takes for high-speed transactions to occur just so they can beat the other guy and have a competitive advantage. So I think until I don't think we're going to get rid of data centers in vulnerable parts of Lower Manhattan. What I think they may do is change how those data centers are built so that next time they'll be able to survive this sort of thing.
Well, and I think if you're co-locating, if you're putting your data center somewhere, I mean, how much homework should you do on the place where you're, putting your data center? I mean, they can say, well, we have generators, and all that, but should you look, where are your generators located, what risks are there to you having natural disasters and things like that, and how much work should you as a customer to these data centers do in order before you, commit. I mean, as you said, Keith, I think Gizmodo moved their operations to a different data center because of these issues. And now, could they have done more research before they moved into this data center and saw that there was potential for this? Or is this something that, it's not that big of a deal? I don't know, but I'm just wondering how much work should people do before they commit to, a co-located data center.
Well, I don't know how much. I know there's a lot of work. Let's say that there's a lot of work, and that needs to be a consideration. But I think what's more important is even if you're using a co-located data center, you still need to have a backup plan. That might mean you have another co-located data center where you keep your backup operations at, because relying on one data center, even if it has the best redundancy capabilities, is still a risk. And then it becomes a financial trade-off, as Mike was talking about. How much money is necessary to ensure our operations? What does it cost us to be down? If the price of us being down for a period of time is higher than what it would cost to make sure that we're not down, then I think we're going to invest in making sure we're not down. And that might mean putting your systems or backup set or partial operations in another facility so that you cannot be totally down. You can run in a degraded state. You can have some services that don't work. You can have limited capacity, but at least you're still up. And then if you're in limited capacity mode, you can start adding capacity until your primary data center comes back online. If That's what happens. And if it never comes back online, you still got some operations and you move to a third data center. There's got to be some sort of consideration of these things. Even in the hospital environments that we've done assessments in, we frequently asked, you know, what happens if this data center goes away? Where do you go after this? Some of them have answers to that. Some of them don't. And some of them don't have very good answers. But typically they, you know, a lot of cases it's like, oh, I've got a clinic on the other side of town and we're connected via fiber. We've got our backup servers out there. We're backing up data to that location. And you have extra racks? Yes, we have extra racks. We can get equipment here in 2 days' time. So they can still be up. They're not down a whole significant amount of time. But they've got this plan at least. I don't know that, you know, a lot of times when you walk into a very nice, well-run data center, you're thinking, well, this has got everything I need. But there's always a problem that can occur, even with the best-run data centers. I mean, we kind of consider Amazon Web Services to be a pretty interesting service with lots of stuff, yet their East data center has been down like 6 times this year, something like that. Thankfully, with the availability zones, you can select a different, you know, data center to operate from. Again, that's additional cost, but that might be worth it. If you're working as a tenant in a co-located data center, maybe not putting all your eggs in one basket is a good idea. But again, it's a trade-off. You know, how much downtime can I afford to have? And this needs to be part of the whole risk mitigation process, risk analysis process.
Yeah, and I think that's the take-home message from Hurricane Sandy and the battle these data centers have been facing is it's a good opportunity to review your disaster recovery plans and look at how would you deal with something similar in your area. It might not be a hurricane, depending upon where you're located, but what if a tornado came through? What if there was significant flooding? You know, what if your building was destroyed? How well equipped are you? And like you said, there's so many trade-offs. You know, are you going to be split between a couple different data centers? Can you handle the cost for that? What is the real downtime? I've worked on several projects, and some of them, in all reality, they can be down 2 or 3 days, and there's really not much impact. Availability is not the highest concern for that project. Where on others, while the data is not very confidential, the availability is key. And, you know, an hour of downtime results in loss of funding because you're making money every hour that site is up. So it's a good opportunity just to review what you have and say, you know, where are we at and what can we learn from this? Okay, our final article for the day is related to the election. We are 1 week removed from the election, and we thought it would be interesting to kind of look at items related to the voting machines, and we talked about that on the last podcast, and I found one article on MSNBC titled Machine Turns Vote for Obama into One for Romney, and in this particular article, it was actually a software developer that was at the while he was trying to place his vote in Pennsylvania, he was trying to select Barack Obama, and as he clicked on the screen, it kept highlighting Mitt Romney, and there was a third choice, Jill Stein. And when he tried to select her, it highlighted just fine. So he basically went up to one of the volunteers and made a complaint and said, "Hey, something's not quite right here," and they more or less said, you know, he's like, look, if I click here, and there was just a little space where he could click and he could go the vote for Barack Obama. And once he showed the volunteer that, the volunteer's like, well, it's okay because your vote's going to get counted correctly. Don't worry about it. But this particular voter happened to be a software developer and felt this is not right. Something weird's going on. So he took out his mobile device, it appears, and video recorded the functionality. He posted it onto YouTube. And Basically, I think the machine was later taken offline once it got some attention from YouTube, and they recalibrated it and put it back into use. So this is just sort of an example of where the calibration in this case was causing a vote, you know, potentially marking the wrong vote. Now, it was clear, if you watch the YouTube video, it's clear who's highlighted. So this is not a matter of, you know, it was showing him it wasn't showing him Obama and actually picking Romney behind the scenes. It was showing that Romney was highlighted when he was clicking an area of the screen that was highlighted for Obama. So this was the most relevant thing I could find related to the election and anything along the lines of how these machines behaved or whether or not there was any malfunctioning. I didn't find too many other things, but it did, ironically, it kind of raised some concern about the machines, and it appeared that the Republican Party had actually sent a letter to election officials in six states prior to the election, noting that the opposite could occur with the machines and asking for them to be calibrated. So, you know, I thought this was interesting based on our topic from last time. And we talked heavily on our last podcast about the paper trail. And, you know, and I look at this and I see it and I'm like, you know what? If we just went to the optical scan ballots, right, just get rid of the machines, this problem would have been eliminated. Now, it may cause some other issues. Maybe you don't get the calculations quite as quickly, though. As you've seen from the election results, it takes a while for the election results to come in either way. But I wonder if we kind of reached a point where, you know, maybe just a straight paper ballot, maybe that's the easiest thing for all voters to understand, and we can avoid the speculation. Now the software developer that posted this, he did not state that he believed that there was anything funny going on in the software or anything. It just appeared to be a calibration issue. It doesn't appear that there's any malintention here, just a matter of a machine that was malfunctioning in this case. And so, you know, I wanted to bring that up today and see what you guys thought about this.
Well, watching the video, it does appear like a calibration issue. It doesn't say what kind of machine it is, nor do we know how old it is. But I seem to recall when I used to have my Palm Pilot, you had to calibrate the screen. It would show you an X, and you had to touch your finger on exactly on that X, and it would do it in the corners. And that's how you calibrated the touchscreen interface. And it looks like that because if you ever got out of calibration, you'd be touching in the – it would be like an inch off below or above or something like that. So that's what it kind of looks like. You hope it's just a calibration issue. But again, we don't know how votes are recorded on the machine. We don't have a lot of, assuming they go through their checklist and they test it to verify that the tally comes out correct in their test. Well, we, you know, hope for the best here, but the question is, this is one calibration problem. How many more were there that were not reported? If the volunteer says, oh, yeah, don't worry, your vote's going to be counted correctly, that should send up red flags for any software people. But that won't send up red flags for everybody. They're going to believe what the volunteer tells them. And so I wonder if there are other issues floating around out there that this one was reported, but how many more issues might have occurred? The question we may never have an answer to.
Well, the other thing to remember about these voting machines is I believe some of them are stored in questionable environmental conditions and in questionable locations where humidity and temperature is probably not taken into account. And they're, you know, used once a year, if that. I'm sure during that maybe once every 4 years, because they probably don't bring out every single voting machine during the off years. So these machines are used very infrequently, and they probably get kind of out of calibration, I guess, when they're within the questionable environmental conditions that they're subjected to.
Well, in the The other thing I found interesting about the article is that this voter had a chance, you know, it was because he took out his phone and he recorded his vote and he posted it that this machine ultimately got pulled and recalibrated. But it got me wondering, was that even legal? You know, inside a while you're casting your vote, is it legal? And there'll be a link in the show notes for today that of a site that kind of lists the laws related by state. And in Pennsylvania, it does appear that it is legal, but there's some exceptions. So it's one of those things where you know how law can be sometimes. It says it prohibits the law prohibits a voter from revealing a ballot or the face of the voting machine voted by him to be seen by any person with the apparent intention of letting it be known how he is about to vote. And then there was some description that says this would appear to prohibit the actual live submitting of the ballot, but once the vote has been cast, then it wouldn't necessarily be a violation. So I guess in this case, I don't know. I don't think he's going to be any trouble as far as technically the law goes. But it's something to consider. There are states that just outright outlaw it. There are some states that just prohibit you from bringing in a cellular device like that. And in this case, had he been in a state that would have prevented him from doing that, if one of the volunteers would have made him stop from recording it, he wouldn't have been able to post it to YouTube. It wouldn't have gotten the attention, and most likely the machine would have remained in circulation with the calibration issue. So I just thought that was another kind of side item here. Really, you know, since we're doing a security podcast, to beware of, if you ever find yourself in that situation too, it might be good to be aware of what your state laws are, because the act of recording your vote might actually be illegal in your state.
Okay, well, we'll wrap up the podcast then. I wanted to thank Keith Watson and Mike Hill, as well as Sirius and Secure Purdue. I'm Preston Wiley. Have a safe and secure day.